Mr. Cheeseman, Reel 3. You went to the Dole School there, Mr. Cheeseman. What happened to you there?
Oh, yes. It was actually an introduction to my life as an engineer, really. Because of unions and what have you, in those days, very strong, the peculiar thing was that the instructors there were not allowed to instruct and teach us a trade. However, we were quite permitted to ask the instructor the questions which he could answer. Rather strange. Now, the things that were on offer as regards training, if I can put that in brackets, in inverted commas, was woodwork, which I wasn't particularly interested in, metalwork, and engineering drawing and English, which of course I certainly wasn't interested in. I decided to tackle first the engineering drawing. I thought I would get a foundation that way. And I quickly picked up, the instructor was quite surprised how quickly I picked up the elevations and sign plan and isometric drawings and what have you. And of course I was quite good at drawing in any case. Now, at the same time, an uncle of mine who was employed by the South Durham Iron and Steel at Hartlepool took me round the steelworks at Hartlepool. You can imagine that was absolute heaven to me. But he explained how the blast furnaces worked. The hot gases, waste gases, coming off the top, were put through what he called a big stove, a huge steel cylinder which was filled with fire bricks. It was put through that until the fire bricks became very, very hot. Then the fumes were switched to a similar stove, and the air required for the blast furnace was then put through this hot stove, heating the air up. All the gas furnaces, thereby making a wonderful saving, and also getting the temperature right up. And then as it cooled, it would be swapped over the other one, something like that. If you get what I mean. And I thought, my goodness, if you could do that with a railway locomotive, what a saving. So I put this idea down on paper. And the instructor was quite amused at the ingenuity of a kid just turned 14. Now, the Dole School attracted VIPs. In fact, the year before I went there, it had attracted no less a personage than the then Prince of Wales. One day, there was a VIP came, and I was introduced to him, to a name that I never heard before, Nigel Gresley. He became Sir Nigel Gresley, the chairman of the London North Eastern Railway, or rather, I think, the chief engineer. And the instructor brought these drawings out to show him, and he was quite amused. and I was always easy with VIPs, so I asked him boldly if I could have a look round his workshops, the Gateshead, the Greenfields engine shops, which I was duly invited to go and have a look round, and the foreman showed me around there. And I noticed that when all the engines had been cleaned and overhauled, what have you, the small box was whitewashed out. What's the whitewash for, sir? I said to the foreman. He said, well, do you know anything about chemistry? I said, I don't. Oh. He said, there's always sulphur in coal and fuel. And if that sulphur gets onto the tubes of the and what have you, sulphur and water mixing together makes sulfuric acid, and it eats the metal away. Now, the whitewash is alkaline stabilizers. And so it's an easy way of saving the metal on the model. And that always stuck in my mind. But then you see things like that stuck in my mind all the way through my life. And that came in very handy, I'm going ahead here. That came in very handy when I was the engineer in charge of a huge gas works at Hartlepool called the steam reforming plant about 20 years ago. If I might just digress for a moment here, that steam reform, that gas works, we use the normal terms of expert. That gas works supplied gas from Northallerton to the Scottish border and from the North Sea coast to the Irish Sea coast. Quite an important plant. In fact, it was a very important plant. Well, in the middle of winter, the fuel to that place was changed insofar that the sulphur content came up, and this sulphur was blocking up a part of the plant which was shutting it down. There were six furnaces there. And the chairman of the board came down and he said, well, look here, he and I were quite friendly, by the way. He said, look here, Andy, he said, you've got to do something about this. I don't know what, but you've got to do it. We can't change the fuel, it's got to come. Otherwise, the north of England's going to be without gas. And I thought about the whitewash. They all poo-hooed me, but it worked. So, as I say, I was rather proud of saving north of England as gas supply. But as I'm digressing, back to the door school. The time that I was at the door school, obviously it was school hours, and I still carried on with what I mentioned in the last tape, my activities in the Boy Scouts. Now, in the Rover Scouts, that's the Elder Scouts, was a chap. I can't remember his first name, but his second name was Scott. He was the son of the general manager of the Homeside and Southmore Coal Company, of which I eventually got a job on the screens. Now, I was never a great friend of him, but he quite obviously mentioned it to me, to his father, that I was very good at making things and so on like that. Because one day I was called into the manager's office at the colliery, not Mr. Scott, but the colliery manager's office, and he said, how would you like to be apprenticed to the works the company's surveyor? Not engineering, you see. But I thought, yes, okay. However, you see, my lack of scholastical abilities is no good. But he did introduce me to the cadet side of my rescuing. And so I learned about breathing apparatus and mechanical things. I was quite interested. And they actually took me down the pit. To which, it seems strange today, but my father was adamant that I wouldn't, he didn't want me to go to the pit in any case, but no way would he want me to go down the pit. And so he discouraged me. That fell through.
Did you get a dole? Did you get money for being on the dole? No. You just went to dole school?
Yes, there was no dole for.
Were there examinations at the end of the dole school time?
No, you say this union business. No.
So after Dole School, you'd gone to work at the pits, had you?
Yes. The only other function of the Dole School was the employers from all over England, by the way, would apply there and you would go. I my name went down for making apprentice boot making down at Nottingham. But I wasn't chosen at the next thing. But as I say, in desperation, I got this job at the mines. Ordinary labour, amongst all machinery, it was great, but I obviously I was at a dead end.
And what was the work that you were doing?
Well, basically, to begin with, standing at the side of these huge metal conveyors with the coal spread out and picking the stones off, called the screens. And incidentally, it wouldn't be allowed today because the noise there just destroyed your hearing. But I did also go on to various, like, drinking up, stopping the tubs, marshalling the tubs as they came off the out of the cage to the tippler, which were tipped tipping the contents onto the screen. Not a very interesting job, but I was amongst machinery. But it brought to the top what had been boiling away ever since I joined the Scouts, the Army. And so one day I went down to West Stanley Drill Hall. Incidentally, it was the headquarters of the TA company of the DLI there. And of course, those days, so they just stopped short of press ganging people in. You know, if you walked past a recruiting office, a hand came out and you were in. That's the attitude. Right? Anyway, I walked in. Excuse me, sir. I would like to join the Royal Engineers. Engineers, you see. Naive as I was. Oh, but you'd make a fine soldier for your county regiment, the DLIs. No, I want to join the Royal Engineers. Why the Royal Engineers? Engineers! Engines! And of course he put me right that it was civil engineering rather than mechanical engineering. You want to join the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and no Remy then, of course. You want to join the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, but you'd be no good. You're past the boys' entrance age.
How old were you?
I was 2 months off the age of 18 by this time. Remember, 2 months before. And it was very good, actually, for a recruiting sergeant. What you really should do, unless you don't join the DLIs, he was always on about this, is join the Royal Tank Corps. There is a chance of you becoming a driver mechanic, which is sort of semi-skilled. And that's all that's open to you. I'll join the Royal Tank Corps. What's your age? I'm 17 and 10 months. His face dropped. Look, lad, he said, with a twinkle in his eye, just go out of the office and come back in again. Which I did, rather, puzzled, came back in. He says, now how old are you? I said, okay, I'm 18. Grand, he says, grand. He said, I'll send you down to Durham, but you need to go back and have a look. I said, well, I've got a shift to do this afternoon. Oh, that's fair enough. And I give you a warrant for getting on the bus. We'll go down to Durham, the main area, recruiting. So the next day, I went down, and you know, I think I did, as I said, say that when I was a kid, I used to love walking, and on a Saturday morning, I would get as far as the gate, and then turn around and say, don't expect me in for dinner. I think I must have done it that day, because I never came back.
Did your parents know you were joining us?
Oh, yes. They knew that I'd gone down to talk about it, but the next day I said, I'm going down to Durham, I might be back for the afternoon shift, I'm not sure.
How did they take it?
Anyway,
that you were joining up, your parents, how did they take it?
Mixed. Glad to get out of it. They were very, very glad that I was getting out of the mines. But remember, this is just a dozen years from the cessation of the First World War, and everyone was anti-army. You all know you don't want to be in the army, and I can understand their sentiments with the terrible butchery that went on. but I'm digressing. I got home to Durham, and the same thing happened there. Ah, a fine future member of Durham Light Infantry. No, I said, I'm joining the Royal Tank Corps. But, lad, you must join your donor. Look, remember, I was Craig Balch, you know, and I think he was a full lieutenant who was talking at Durham. I said, look, I am joining the Royal Tank Corps, or I'm walking up the door. And that was sufficient. Anyway, I was given an education test, which I suppose I passed with the lowest possible grade that I could possibly, a written test and what have you, and given a medical test, which I passed with great colours. And then I went to the get paid. There was a day's pay plus travelling expenses. And I always remember it was 7 4 that I got in the hand. I left a job which was giving me 5 3 a week. And and that was financially, by joining the army, although it was only 2 shillings a day, it was magnificent financially for me. But anyway,
how did you swear on the Bible and make your...
Then it was, the king and his successor and all that. Yes, I was sworn in and signed, and I became a member of his Royal Tank Corps. There and then, as it were. But this was in the morning. I finished this interview and what have you by about 1 o'clock. The train to London was not, I was booked onto the train to London at 7:30 at night. I was too late to go home and say, I'm in the army, wait, and come back again. It was 8 or 9 miles between Stanley and Durham. So I wandered around Durham, sort of with my feet about 4 feet off the ground. I was, great, magnificent. But was I naive? I was seen on the train at 7:30. I'd never been out of County Durham in my life before. Oh, I'd been a long way. I mean, it was a long way from Stanley to Hartlepool, for instance. It was a long, long way. So, you can imagine my impression on that train. It went for hours and hours and hours and hours on an end. And finally it stopped. Ah, London. I looked out of the train window and saw the train, the station, Darlington. So you can imagine the state that I was, well, not a state, my feelings when I finally landed in King's Cross at 1:30 in the morning. Now, please believe me, this is true. How, I don't know. But the underground was closed, so I had to get to Waterloo. I went out of King's Cross and I saw coffee store. I realised I hadn't eaten since breakfast that morning. So I had a mug of tea and a sandwich, and I asked the coffee store owner the way to Waterloo. And you know how coffee is. Well, you take the first ring of there, and you could go up the ring of Oh, well, what's he talking about? But I did remember he go up the road, if you used to go across, to the second lot of traffic lights and turn left. Which I did, and I never asked the way anymore, and I got to Waterloo. I think my instincts as a, or my map reading, as it were, in the Boy Scout came in very handy, so I was thinking. But anyway, I got to Waterloo, and this would be about 5 o'clock. Oh, talking about naivety again. I actually did make a point of looking at the pavements of London and tell you they weren't made of gold. My train from Waterloo didn't leave until about 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was a stopping train to Weymouth. So when I got off at Moore, my end of my train journey, it was about 1 o'clock. And here again, I could have taken three roads. I could have turned left and gone into Wall and gone further, and I would probably ended up in the English Channel. I could have turned right and gone towards Weymouth, or I could have turned right and then left all the level crossings, and another fork further up the road and what have you, and get to the camp, Bovington. I found my way without having to retrace my steps. I don't know, but that's it. But here's, and this is true, by the way, this will show you how unstreetwise, naive that I was. I was walking up the road to this conglomeration of First World War army huts on the brow lane, when I heard an awful lot of screaming, and my heart dropped for the first time since I left home. That's a squad of fellas being put through the paces. Poor sobs. I nearly turned back. I bet you couldn't guess what the screaming was. It was the pigsty.
A lot of pigs, you know, when they get fed, it's squealing. I honestly believe it was.
Anyway, got to the guard house, and of course a sentry walking up and down, walked into the guard room, and I was rather surprised that they didn't welcome me with open arms.
Yes, what do you want?
Give them the papers. Right. All right. Came out this chap. Take him up. And took me up to the recruits reception. All army huts, by the way, Bovington was the old name. Took me up to the army hut, recruits hut. There was a lance corporal in charge of that, and it was fairly full at the time. Actually, what they used to do was, when there was sufficient to make a training squad, they would move you out, and then they would start all over again. Now then, the first man that went in there, he could be probably in there 3 weeks waiting for... I was lucky in so far that I was about the last one. Otherwise, I would have had 3 weeks of fatigues to look at while I was there. But here again, here's showing you how naive I really was. I'm jumping ahead of the story here. When I went up there, I was handed over to this lance corporal who said, "You got any luggage?" "No, I got no luggage." "Oh, fair enough." So I was given a razor, a bit of soap, bedding, of course, and a large sheet of sandpaper. Well, it was it was a towel, actually, but by Jesus, and you know, that was my on a toothbrush, and that was my luggage. I was shown the bed and three biscuits and four blankets, two sheets, and a pillow, which was like a drinking tent, as it were. This was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I sat in the lance corporal in charge went into my own room, which was inside, and left me to be there. And I just sort of looked around and what have you, explored. And the hut configuration, the accommodation huts, that was the same as all the huts then in Bovington camp. They were in like H block. two huts parallel like that, and then the annex connecting the two. And I looked at the annex, you know, it's just the corn wall for there by there. And come 5 o'clock, the other people that were, other recruits that had been on fatigues, came back in, and quite a number of them had smutty faces, and they were in boiler suits. And I was so jealous of them, that they'd been working on tanks, you see. And I'd been wasting my time in the army. Because I hadn't been working on tanks, and been on coal fatigue. Anyway, come Monday morning.
How many people were in the hut?
There would be about 30 of us. I think it was 30 a squad.
All strangers to you, of course.
All strangers from all over, you know, Scotland and what have you. Jock McAllister and Taffy. Oh, there was tons of, you know, and from all walks of life. We actually had a resting actor. incidentally, that was a phenomenon which became every day, you know, people from all walks of life. I'll not talk about that at the moment because they will come in later on.
But there were about 30 in the hut.
Yes.
And none of you had uniforms at this point.
No. Anyway, come Monday morning, we were introduced to Sergeant Rivers, Bill Rivers. He was about 5'9", very, very fit, and very, very loud old voice. But he turned out to be a smashing NCO. Oh, by jingles, he knew how to tear a strip off you, all right. Yes, I accept that. And it was hard going for me because I was bossy. But when I finally said cheerio to him, I was saying cheerio to his father. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Our training. Well, first of all, he took us away from the recruit's hut, down the pair of huts, down to an empty pair of huts in the lines, B company lines, and marched us that way, and then he marched us down to the quartermaster's, get our belly, brought our belly, and all the cleaning material for the hut. And we were taught domestic to start with, how to look after the huts, how to make our beds, and what have you.
And how was this done? What were they telling you?
Oh, Sergeant, you know, and he was, when I look back, he was quite humane and quite fatherly, really, at the time. My goodness, you know, but he taught us how the basics of living in a hut. Took us across to the dining room where we were segregated completely from the rest of B Company, which was the training side. A Company was the administration, the instructors and all that sort of thing. B Company was the recruits. We were segregated from the rest of B Company. Brought us back again and told us what to expect next morning. 6 o'clock, we've had luck, we got some, what have you, still in series, and not march us down to the quartermaster's stores to be measured and given our uniform.